is not complicated. What politics is about is trying to understand where we are today, how we got to where we are, and maybe most importantly, where we want to go in the future. Now, you may think that that's a pretty simple proposition. Well, where are we today? What's the problem? We all know where we are. Well, we don't. Where do we want to go in the future? Are we really discussing that? So I want to start off with a proposition, and I'm going to say it over and over again. We are the wealthiest country in the history of the world. There is no excuse why every man, woman, and child in this country is not enjoying a decent standard of living. Period. And everybody in America has got to understand it. No excuse for 800,000 Americans sleeping out on the street, or so many of us not having quality health care. No excuse at all. So what is going on in America today? Well, what the media doesn't talk about very often, and what you almost never hear in the halls of Congress, is the reality that today you are living in a nation where a handful of incredibly wealthy people, multi-billionaires, have enormous power and control over our economy, over our media, over our political system, and we are gathered here today to say that is going to change. Today in America, we have more income and wealth inequality than we have ever had in the history of this country. You all got that? Never been more unequal, not in the 1920s, not in the 1860s, than it is today. Today, and again, one of the things the media does, and what the establishment does, and the whole culture, not a conspiracy, it just happens, is they kind of tell us what we should be upset about, what we should be outraged about. If some kid with a gun goes into a 7-Eleven, we're supposed to be outraged. We are. That's a crime. But somehow we are not outraged when so few have so much and so many have so little. Well, I think we should be outraged at that. In America today, if you can believe it, if you can believe it, one person, our good friend Mr. Musk, you are familiar with Mr. Musk. One man owns more wealth than the bottom 52% of American households. You got that? Can you believe that? I mean, it is to me, now you don't hear that discussed very much, right? I think I'm one of the few people who talk about it. So in the richest country on earth, it doesn't matter how rich we are because of this massive inequality. One guy, more wealth than the bottom 52%, the top 1%, more wealth than the bottom 93%. CEOs today are making 350 times more than the average worker. Today in America, you have more concentration of economic ownership in sector after sector, whether it's media, financial services, agriculture, transportation, you name it, a handful of giant corporations control what is produced and what you pay for those products.
Starting the day I take the oath of office, I will rapidly drive prices down and we will make America affordable again.
In the campaign, the big promise by Donald Trump was that he was going to bring down prices and make America affordable again. And everything he's done is the opposite of that. So, you know, if you were asking Imported goods are going up in price. We're going to see a lot more than that of that. But, you know, vegetables are going up in price. And a little bit of that is tariffs, but a lot of that is farm workers are making themselves scarce because they're afraid that ICE will pick them up. If we're worried about housing costs, a lot of the construction industry's immigrant workers, and particularly the actual physical jobs, the guys actually up there on the roof, tend to be immigrants, many of them undocumented, and even the ones who are legal are afraid.
Ultimately, I think what really matters is the standard of living.
Yeah.
For Americans across the board. What are we doing to the standard of living? Are we improving it, or are we actually turning it down?
Oh, no, this is clearly all negative for the standard of living. You're making, you know, when you put a tariff on, one way of putting it, the sort of standard economist, Econ 101 thing is, you're taking things that we do relatively badly and other countries do relatively well, and we're insisting that those things be done here, which raises costs, reduces our standard of living. If we look at the immigration policies, the really important thing about immigration in America is that the immigrants do not do the same jobs that native-born Americans do. They're very concentrated in a limited number of industries and occupations, which are very much complementary to the jobs that native-born Americans do. And by driving out the immigrants, we are reducing the productivity, reducing ultimately the living standard of the native-born workers.
Trump tariffs are a part of the story that Krugman knows well. His Nobel Prize was awarded in 2008 for work on trade patterns. But he says the tariffs themselves might not be the biggest problem.
Consistent tariffs are bad, but not as bad as legend has it, right? You know, everybody's said Smoot-Hawley caused the Great Depression. That's not remotely true. And if you run even Trump's tariffs as they stand at the moment through a sort of standard model, they will reduce GDP by something like half a percentage point in the long run. It's serious, it's bad, it does terrible things to U.S. credibility because we're breaking all of our agreements, but it's not a huge thing. What we've never had before is tariffs where nobody knows what the tariff rates will be next month, let alone, you know, a year, 2 years from now. It's this complete, utter chaos. It's sort of the whims of the president, and then the question of whether the courts even allow him to do what he's doing, which wreaks havoc with business. Any investment a business makes right now has a good chance of turning out to be a really bad investment because the tariff rate isn't what you thought it would be.
What about margins for corporations? Because typically you might see it show up there. It's suggested that part of the reason we're not seeing tariffs is some of it's being absorbed by exporters, some by importers, and some by consumers.
The exporters are not absorbing very much. We have independent data on prices actually charged by foreign countries for their exports to the United States, and those have not gone down. So it does not look as if foreigners are absorbing a significant amount. It does look like U.S. businesses have so far absorbed a significant amount. Partly that's because they rushed inventory in, they rushed imports in to front-run the tariffs. Partly because they're not sure if the tariffs are here to stay. They don't want to raise prices and alienate consumers until they have no choice. But no, it looks quite significant. And it's really important also to understand that, you know, this is not William McKinley's world economy. This is not what Trump thinks it is. This is not a world in which you export manufactured goods and you export farm goods and that's it. This is a world of supply chains, complicated structures, and very many of the tariffs are actually being levied on inputs into U.S. manufacturing. So this is doing a lot to actually raise costs of U.S. businesses as well. So there isn't a lot of slack in the end. I'm enough of a, you know, I may be kind of center-left, but I don't believe that businesses are making massive profits that can just be legislated away. So in the end, businesses won't be able to absorb them, and it's consumers.
What about the stated goals of President Trump, whether he's achieving them or not? One of them is actually protect or bring back manufacturing jobs onshore of the United States. Is that a sensible goal? And by the way, how is it affecting the auto industry? Because the auto industry supposedly is one of the beneficiaries of all this.
Yeah, the auto industry actually is sort of case in point for, you know, this is not actually working. And it's for the auto industry, a lot of it has to do with the fact that there isn't a U.S. auto industry. There's a North American auto industry. It's very integrated with Canada and Mexico. Parts of an individual car may cross a border 7 or 8 times before you end up with a finished vehicle. And all of this stuff is adding costs. So the auto industry is particularly ill-suited. You know, steel and aluminum. What do you make cars out of? And we have tariffs on steel and aluminum.
Could there be an ironic, unintended effect, which is actually as you put more and more pressure on the costs for manufacturers, they automate more. So it doesn't turn into jobs. It might turn into GDP. It doesn't turn into jobs.
Well, just in general, even aside from the cost pressures specifically, if you ask yourself which industries might be induced to come back to the United States, it'll be industries where the labor cost disadvantage is not too large. We're not going to be bringing back apparel. There's just no way, unless you have just hundreds of percent tariffs, that we're going to bring clothing manufacturer back from Bangladesh to the Carolinas. What you can bring back conceivably are industries where they're very capital intensive. Their robots do a lot of the work. So we may be creating more jobs for robots, but not a whole lot of jobs for U.S. workers.
There is the effect, apparently, we hear from Secretary Bessent, on the deficit. That in fact, we are putting a lot more money into the Treasury because of these tariffs. Is it helping us on the debt and deficit?
Well, in the direct effect, look, tariffs are basically a tax. They're a sales tax that are levied on selected goods. It's a sales tax on goods that we import. And sure, if I put on a national sales tax, it would raise revenue and reduce the deficit. And, a lot of economists have said the United States really should have a value-added tax, which is basically a sales tax, and most other advanced countries do that, and we kind of could use the money. So through a backdoor route, Trump is making America a little bit more like Denmark with a sales tax paying for part of the budget. But it's really not going to be enough money.
But Secretary Bessent has said it's like $300 billion.
It's extremely unlikely that we'll get that much, although it's possible. If we're increasing tariff rates by around 15 points, that could get you to several hundred billion dollars. But the idea that if you impose a tax, it raises money, that's not an exotic, that's not a policy triumph. That's just how budgets work.
Are you concerned about the long-term permanent effects of what's happening right now, rather than just the ups and downs, the vicissitudes of an electoral system?
What people don't, I think, fully realize is that on tariffs, almost everything Trump has done is probably illegal under U.S. law, but definitely a violation of international agreements. I mean, we built the world trading system, and I say we because that's the United States. The U.S. created this thing, which is a system of rules and laws. We've just ripped up a whole system of trading agreements, a system that we built over 90 years, because this really goes back to FDR. You don't put that back together, even if the next president says, okay, everything, my first act is to undo everything Trump did. The United States will never be trusted again. We used to be a country where if we made an agreement, that was an agreement. I mean, I was in the Reagan administration working on trade things, and there would be meetings in which some proposal would be floated. And the guy from the U.S. Trade Representative's office would say that would be GATT illegal, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which binds this, and end of discussion. In the Reagan administration, if it was a violation of our international agreements, we didn't do it. This administration doesn't care. They don't even try to justify violating these agreements.
Even as the Trump administration charts a very different economic path for the U.S. overall, Krugman's home city of New York is facing its own potential shift. As the self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani is ahead in the polls for the mayoral race, Krugman is more sanguine about what that could mean.
What we call a socialist in America, it would be just kind of a social democrat in Europe. It's really not extreme. Some of his proposals might be a little, I'm not sure about the rent stuff. I actually don't think that opening some city-run groceries is a problem. In practice, he would almost surely govern pretty much just a slightly more populist version of what we have. I don't think we need to worry about radical change.
But the rent stuff, as you called it, the problem is affordability of housing in New York, really freezing rents is not traditionally the way to get more housing stock built.
Yeah, but what he's talking about is not freezing all rents. He's talking about stabilizing stuff that's already rent controlled. And so it's really, it's a policy at the margin. It's probably not likely to have much effect on housing construction. And it does sound, from other things he said, that he really would try to get a lot of housing built. And that's the important thing. I'm not really worried about that. And it's, you know, the panic over what really wouldn't be very different from the way New York City has been governed is all wrong. And it would take a lot to really ruin this city. The resilience of New York City has just been amazing over the years.
That was Paul Krugman on the economy.
Americans are grappling with the economy facing rising prices and a slowdown in hiring, fueled in part by President Trump's tariffs on imported goods. Economists expected the U.S. to add 75,000 net new jobs in August, which would have been alarmingly low. Instead, only 22,000 materialized, and the unemployment rate rose to 4.3%. That was a slight jump from July. But Black Americans have seen their jobless rate jump even faster. At 7.5%, they currently face the highest unemployment rate of any racial group, higher than the white population at 3.7%, higher than Asians at 3.6%. Both groups have jobless rates, by the way, which are below the overall population unemployment rate of 4.3%. But if you dig deeper, the sharpest spike even there is happening among Black women. Take a look at this graph. In February, when President Trump was settling down into the White House again, there were more than 10.5 million Black women working in the labor force. But according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 306,000 have lost their jobs since then, stripping around $37 billion from the U.S. economy, according to the gender economist Katika Roy. Many economists point to Trump's massive cuts to the federal workforce as the driving factor. This is interesting. Black women alone make up over 12% of federal employees. That's nearly double their share of the labor force overall. And that's not by accident. For decades, Black women have pursued public sector jobs as a pathway to the middle class. Government jobs often come with civil service protections against discrimination and pay inequity, which is critical because Black women still face the largest wage gap in America even today. But those protections are evaporating. Many of the agencies that Donald Trump targeted in his budget cuts are agencies where Black women make up a larger share of the staff. For example, the Department of Education, 28% of employees were Black women. The department staff was cut by nearly 46%. By contrast, agencies with largely white staff, like the Department of Energy and Justice, saw cuts of just 13% and 1%, respectively, according to government data. But even Black women who work in the private sector are being targeted. They make up a large share of the country's diversity, equity, and inclusion officers. And as more companies bow to political pressure to roll back DEI initiatives, these women are being pushed out of the workforce as well. Here's the thing. Even if you're not a Black woman, all of this should alarm you. Economic policy expert Jessica Fulton explains that a sharp jump in Black women's joblessness may foreshadow an impending slowdown for other groups, too. She says Black women, quote, show up as a canary in the coal mine, giving a picture of what may happen to everyone else later, end quote. Katika Roy goes further, calling these cuts a strategic failure with long-term consequences that robs the country of leadership, innovation, and entrepreneurial capacity. Because when over 300,000 people from one particular demographic drop out of the workforce in a matter of months, that's not one community's problem. It's a structural problem for the U.S. economy. Joining me now, Derek Hamilton. He's the chief economist at the AFL-CIO, the nation's largest labor federation. Hamilton is also a professor of economics and urban policy at the New School. I'm also here with the Democratic congresswoman from Wisconsin, Gwen Moore. Gwen Moore is she serves on the House Ways and Means Committee. She has a unique experience in this. Her father was a union factory worker. Her mother was a public school teacher. They're both great friends of the show. Welcome to both of you. Congresswoman, thank you. Let me start with you because you and I have had this discussion before. You can go back to sort of the end of slavery all the way through the Great Migration. There were protections in the public service that did not yet exist in the private sector, which attracted a lot of Black women and Black people into these jobs. So when these kinds of cuts happen, they're going to hit Black people and Black women disproportionately.
Listen, I am certainly in the amen corner. I mean, your setup was perfect, Velshi, and I'm really glad that you lifted up the part that Black people, and especially Black women, sought employment in the federal government, mm-hmm. because quite frankly, the federal government was first to make efforts to integrate and diversify its workforce. Not only did people get good pay or decent fair pay, but they got benefits like pension benefits. And so that's why Black women are disproportionately represented in the workforce. I'm also glad that you raised the point that Donald Trump, in his effort to destroy DEI, deliberately targeted agencies like USAID, where 40% of its workforce is a minority, where the Department of Education, certainly 28% of its workforce are Black people, and then targeting like the labor and statistics position, or Dr. Hayden from the Library of Congress, deliberately targeting, using the algorithms, anyone who went to a diversity, equity, and inclusion training, or anybody who's Black. And the result of that is that since February, from February to July, 319,000 Black women have lost their jobs, largely due to the federal purges, whereas white men employment has increased, and even Hispanic employment has increased. So when you look at the pitiful job numbers that you just raised, it's because Black women sustained a huge blow. And as you mentioned, that impact will ripple throughout the economy.
Derek, it is known worldwide that if women are employed, families do better. In America, after the end of slavery, what ended up happening is a lot of people ended up as sharecroppers. So you didn't make any money. For 20, 30, 40 years, you weren't enslaved, but you still came out with less money at the end of the year than you started. In addition to what the Congresswoman says about benefits and protections, civil service jobs were a ladder opportunity for Black people, right? It was a job, and many people had children who then took jobs in those in the civil service. This was a way to try and make up for the decades in which Black people could earn zero money. We haven't solved that problem. The wealth gap between white and Black people is still massive.
Yeah, I mean, bureaucracy isn't all bad. Bureaucracy has rules and gets rid of discretion, like discrimination. So I think the message that we're getting from the Congresswoman, as well as Jessica Fulton, and your phrasing around this being structural, is that we see this and it's horrendous. It's a shame that we have such high unemployment rates for Black women and Black people in general, Black men, relative to everybody else. But the implications, not only on them, but for our society writ large, the canaries in the coal mine, we can expect that this could be ominous for what we can expect to come going forward. And then the other big point is you can't separate Black men and women so neatly from a larger family context.
Right.
So this leads to, you know, more strains on caregiving, more strains on households in general to be able to thrive and survive.
You know, so it's not just that Black women are losing jobs. They're losing access to health care. Mm-hmm. They're losing access to having contributions made toward their 529 or to their retirement accounts. They're losing money toward buoying their Social Security in the end. And that, the point that you made earlier, and it's true, that when you give women money, mm-hmm. you're helping the whole family.
Yep.
That's anywhere in the world. So this structural inequality among Black women will eventually create a huge deterioration in the entire economy as they don't consume as much. They don't get SNAP, formerly called food stamps, to be able to expend that. And I mean, this contagion, I believe, will spill out throughout the entire economy.
Let's extend this, Derek. Let's put aside even the benefits of SNAP or Medicare, Medicaid, things like that. Let's just talk about black women as consumers and taxpayers in society, right? If we are, our goal as a society is to what we call full employment, right? Get everybody who's capable of working and willing to work to be able to work. When you start to disentangle people from the workforce, it costs us all. So 300,000 unemployed black women is not just 300,000 unemployed black households' problem. We're all somehow suffering for this.
That's right. So aggregate demand suffers when we have parts of our economy suffer in terms of wages, income, and employment. And then another big point, Ali, is the fact that these jobs are productive. What the jobs create and what they do for the American public. This is our public infrastructure. You led with the Department of Education.
Right.
I mean, the Department of Education, we want a well-educated society that can go out and produce. So that also is a big point that we should pay attention to, the fact that we are dismantling our public infrastructure, and then here's the other point, for authoritative purposes.
Yep.
So that a person can have greater control to enrich whatever whim they may have, not for our benefit, but for the particular benefit of this administration.
I want to just put that the unemployment rate for black women back up on the screen, Derek. The unemployment rate for black women was 5.4% in January, still much higher than the rate for all Americans. It's jumped to 6.7%. Now, if you're not into statistics or economics, that doesn't look like that big a deal. That's a huge deal.
That is a huge deal. I mean, in a relatively short period of time, that increase is not only big for black women, and you know, we got to point out that the black male rate is 7.1% as well. But in addition to the fact that we just had this huge increase, the point that Jessica Fulton made, canary in the coal mine, this is what we can expect to happen for the rest of the economy. The same adage, black people are the first fired, last hired, is indicative is what might come for the rest of us. So what we need is strong collective bargaining. What we need is solidarity. We need to recognize that when you go after black women, that chink in solidarity is indicative not just of class interests, but an interest of an inclusion of all people so that we can better fight for wages for all of us. This won't just affect black women. It's going to spill over to the whole economy.
But how some of it's working, I am seeing responses from Americans in these protests, in these town halls, that the American voter, the American public, we just released a new poll this morning, they think this is wrong and they're prepared to fight. They want to make sure that Congress is with them in that fight.
Thank you for lifting that up, because we spend so much time commiserating over where we are. But I'm old enough to remember how we have won in the past. It's with this coalition building, you know, and Donald Trump has deliberately taken a chainsaw, to use their terms, to employment for black and people, and particularly black women.
Welcome.
All right, everyone, welcome home. This is a Native Land Pod mini pod, and we are thrilled to be joined today by an incredible hero. Young people make waves, and she is no exception. We witnessed her unlawful arrest in D.C. just a few weeks ago as D.C. continues to be under occupation by the federal government. And I got to tell y'all, this particular young lady is someone who I was like, now this is who the ancestors are speaking through. And I just really want to commend you for your courage, for your bold voice. And if any, we want to welcome you home to Native Land Pod. We're so happy to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I've seen all of you on TV various times, so excited to be here.
We're very grateful to share space with you. I would love if you would be so kind to just share what happened when you were detained, and what your experience was in being detained by these officers who did all the things, including pepper spray you. If any, please talk about your experience and what other young people are going through in D.C. right now.
First of all, I was out doing cop watch with an organization called Harriet's Wildest Dreams. They're also in partnership with Free DC. So what we were doing was lawful and legal. We've done it for years. My experience with the Metro Transit Police that detained me, specifically one officer named Sergeant Deal, was that I was singled out from the rest of my group, and I was brutalized and arrested. When I was pepper sprayed, they like subsequently poured water like all down the front of me. So like the pepper spray kind of like spread down to everything that you could imagine. I was kept in multiple police cars for hours. They took me to the hospital. They didn't do much. But I was arrested at 10. I didn't get processed until 6 a.m. And throughout all that time, I was handcuffed with my hands behind my back, either in a police car or at the hospital for a few hours. And I was getting pepper sprayed over and over and over again throughout the night, like anytime I sweat or cried or anything like that. And also the whole front of my clothes were wet. So, it was, I don't know. I feel like mentally very different. I've been doing this work for a while. It's not my first time being arrested. It's my first time being arrested in about 5 years. This one was like very different, and it might be because of the context of everything else that's going on with young people, with undocumented people, with documented people who migrated to this city, who are being snatched off the streets, never to see their families again. You know, I was released the next day. I was in a lot of pain, but I was released the next day. People's lives are being changed by the ways in which the Trump administration, Jeanine Pirro being our new AG, and also our mayor really just kind of not really doing much in the way of like actually fighting this. People from D.C. get sent all over the country when they get incarcerated. There's no state prison, and we have like about 3,500 beds. There's nowhere to hold all these people, so they end up getting sent anywhere that they can fit them. And this will be Black people disproportionately that are impacted in the district by this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Afeni, can I ask you, we spoke about Mayor Bowser and how she's interacted with the Trump administration. We spoke about it on last week's episode of NLP. And I noted in conversations I had in person with people and in a lot of the comments that some people were taken aback by our response and pushed back a little bit and said, listen, Mayor Bowser is in a very difficult spot. Why would we criticize this Black woman mayor who's doing the best that she can? And they thought we were a little insensitive and perhaps naive to the position that she's in. And just so you know, our position was, if you're not going to win with Trump, then why not be a revolution? I'm just curious what you might say to people who have that pushback for us and maybe even you.
I would say that even up until this occupation, Mayor Bowser, throughout this entire year, has been taking tiny steps or big steps, depending on what you're thinking about, towards the Trump administration and being in line with their agenda. Home rule is a very sensitive topic. Even if they could institute a control board and not even have to repeal home rule, and they could institute a control board in Congress, and our autonomy would essentially be cooked. I understand that fear, but everything that Trump asked for the mayor to put in our budget to like get repealed, it happened. Sanctuary city status, she tried to repeal that through the budget. That is not a budget item, so our council stripped that out. She also wanted to do away with ranked choice voting. That was a democratically voted on ballot initiative. She wanted to do away with tip wage worker raises. That was another democratically voted on ballot initiative that was voted on twice. Over 70% of the city wanted to see tip wage workers get a raise. And the city council, they partially funded ranked choice voting. They didn't fund it fully like they said they were going to. And they completely did away with I-82, which is the tip, the raise for the tip wage folks. it's kind of hard for me to feel sympathy for her, especially at this time, with my history of like organizing against her, protesting against her, like even meeting with her, talking with her. Muriel has never been interested in like justice or like the interests of working class people or addressing them or the material conditions of people that live in Ward 7 or 8, like where the blackest part of the city. She's never been invested in that. So I'm genuinely not surprised that she's acting this way now. And I really feel like if people have like issues with people criticizing her, they really need to look back at her record and the way that she has presented herself as a mayor, as a Black queer person, as, you know, she says she is. She has not been, she has not legislated like a Democrat. I'll just say it like that.
Well, just because I'm going to pass the mic to you, Andrew, but just because it's people who don't live in D.C. may not be as familiar with D.C. home rule. So just for our viewers and our audience, D.C. home rule is shorthand, essentially, for legislation that passed in Congress in 1973 that gave the D.C. residents some autonomy. Before that, when President Nixon was in office, before that, essentially Congress controlled D.C., and so, you know, they would appoint commissioners and appoint the member of Congress here. D.C. home rule allowed for elections here, even though D.C. is a place where there is taxation without full representation in Congress. So sorry, Andrew.
No. It's like they had a territorial governance,
right.
Structure. What century are we in here in America? And that's partly why, for those of us who visit D.C. Or go there for work, you see that statehood for D.C., you know, plates and the advocacy around that. It is bigger than a number of states that are represented by two U.S. senators in the U.S. Senate. They got more population. Eleanor Holmes Norton is a delegate, a non-voting delegate to the Congress, except for very special situations. I think she can count for quorum, but that's about the whole of it. I want to salute you, sis, for the courage, frankly, by what you've been standing on, quite fearless. And actually, I don't think any of us are without our levels of fear, but you absolutely present quite fearlessly, I think, giving cover and also permission for the people who want to be with you to be with you. I'm stepping back from just sort of this current situation. I'm actually curious sort of, where did this get seated? Where are you from? Where did you grow up? Like, what put you on this path? Because I think there's something to be taken from that and to be shared, you know, with our listeners around how you got to this moment that you've been built for.
So, you know, I'm an Army brat. I was born in Germany. So we did a little bit of moving all over the country, but I spent most of my time really in Maryland. I had like a childhood with a lot of stuff. And I lived in a neighborhood with we always lived in like really well resourced neighborhoods. I was a cheerleader for like 12 years. I played lots of instruments when I was younger. So like, I feel like I really got an opportunity to fully like self-determine, and that has really lended to like the way that I imagine myself as an advocate, an organizer, and like quote unquote, like political figure. My entry point into the movement was the George Floyd uprising. Before that, I was like a full-time college student. I wanted to be a policy advisor, so I was doing political science. Wanted to go to law school, you know, do like campaign work and stuff like that. Then the George Floyd uprising happened, and pretty much my entire life changed from there. Damn, like, sure. I got pulled into like just more radical organizing spaces. My first organization was Freedom Fighters DC. From there, I started working for the movement, working with the Movement for Black Lives. I got a job with Working Families Party. I've done a lot of different organizing. I did some electoral organizing with a congressional campaign in Maryland, legislative work, legislative advocacy in Maryland, the state of Maryland. Now I work for an organization called Fair Budget Coalition. So I do budget equity work in DC, which is also why like my view of Muriel is very, it's deep in the line items. Like, girl, your budget tells a story of what your priorities are, and time and time and time again, like, this is what it's been. So I don't know. I think there are many different things that push me to where I am like now, and like my level of political thought. I read a lot. I have a lot of really great mentors. Most of them are Black women, shout out. I don't know. I'm really grateful. I'm really blessed. And yeah.
Afeni,
yeah,
I want to, I love that Andrew did that, because I do think that there's always a story that we have that anchors who we become, the missions we fulfill, the purpose in life that we chase. So I'm so grateful for your upbringing and for the courage it birthed in you. But I also love what you said at the end about budgets. I worked for the Congressional Black Caucus coming up, and my forever boss, Congressman Cleaver, used to say, your budget will tell you where your heart is. And that's the reason why the CBC would always introduce an alternative budget to tell people where their heart should be. But on this same issue, when the CBC was founded, they had 61 recommendations they took to Richard Nixon. In those recommendations was DC statehood. In the 1972 Gary, Indiana National Black Political Convention, in that agenda was statehood for DC. The Black Papers process that we just went through with State of the People, there is a DC statehood paper. For people who, just like Tiff mentioned earlier, may not understand DC home rule and why it matters, can you speak to a little bit about why this is a fight for the whole of us and not just for the residents of DC?
Absolutely. DC is an experimenting ground for like all the things they want us to try to spread throughout the country. Because of our lack of statehood, you know, there are some ways where, especially like, even if you think about our budget process, like the mayor proposes her budget, the council legislates the budget, votes on the budget, and then the Congress approves our budget. Most of the time, as you, for the most part, they've never really intervened with our affairs. But then we saw congressional interference in 2023 with our criminal code. We've also seen some congressional interference around like our marijuana laws and like our ability to have shrooms recreationally, things that were also voted on democratically through ballot initiative. So the issue of statehood for DC is so important because DC is no longer necessarily majority Black city. It's a plurality Black city. It's about 43 to 46% Black now. And it's also being rapidly gentrified. It's and a lot of that is because like the mayor does some work throughout the year, but the council really only has like 70 days to really look at a budget proposal in DC. And that's what's legislated in the Home Rule Act. So they only have 70 days to like really try to create an environment where transformative change could happen through a budget. And it's like severely stunted. So who your mayor is in DC is very important. Because of that, and because we don't have like senators, we don't have like, you know, we don't have real voting members in Congress. There are many things that directly affect DC. DC pays the highest federal tax rate that we don't actually get a real say on. So not only are we bearing the brunt of like the most like cruelty of whatever administration is in office, we are also like not able to fully represent ourselves as a district and as a city, state, whatever, you know. And there's 700,000 people in the district, of Columbia. So we're like bigger than a couple of states. Like we have bigger populations than a couple of states.
That's real.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Go ahead, Angela.
No. You got it.
I just wanted to say thank you, Lafini, for joining us. We really appreciate your time. And just all the information you provided, and look forward to seeing your future work in activism. So we appreciate it.
Afeni, I know you got to bounce, but last thing, we love to leave people with something and something to do. What would look like support for you all and your movement work in D.C. From people across the country? What does support look like? What would you admonish us to do?
Well, I would say number one, like definitely talk to your representatives about statehood. Statehood is a national issue for DC. And DC should be the 51st state. So that's number one. And I would say number two, for people that live in Black cities like Chicago, like Oakland, Atlanta, he ain't mentioned it yet, but hey, man.
Yeah.
Places like that. Yeah. This is a time to really get deep into like the quality of relationships that you have. We need to be getting to know each other. We need to be building relationships of trust. We need to be organizing in a way that will position us to act courageously and collectively. And we can do it. We do have the power to do to do something. This is not happening to us. We can stop this. It's just you have to be able to be a part of that collective responsibility and take up that mandate of being an active part of the revolution, of the culture, whatever you want to call it. Just be an active part.
Yeah. I love that. I love
thank
that.
You,
we know you got to bounce, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we wish you well.
I wish you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for tuning in. Afeni is so great. I can't wait to see what's powerful in store
sister.
For her and what she has more specifically in store for us. And again, if you like this conversation, a lot of people don't know the politics of the nation's capital. So even if you don't live here, if you're one of the cities she named, please drop this in your group chat, spread, rate, review, subscribe, all of that. Not just to build an audience, but to build community at a time such as this. So we're inviting you all into a space where you have a seat at this table and you can participate in this conversation. So please be sure to spread this conversation and start your own community work. And hopefully Afeni can offer you some guidance there. This conversation, I hope, can offer you some guidance there. Thanks for tuning in to this mini pod and welcome home, y'all.
Welcome home.
After the horde events that took place this week, I've gathered you all here to ask you, to implore you, to please, 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 be fucking for real. To my peers, I hate to tell you, but I have to disagree with some of y'all on this one. This was an act of political violence. This was violence incited by the politicization of a public safety issue, identity politics, and human rights. Charlie Kirk may have not been an elected official, but we have to shift our paradigm and stop trying to force what should be the case onto what is. Why? Because political pundits have more political power than elected officials these days. Because they're the ones that have a direct line and literally feed into the people's faith in their ideology. Charlie Kirk was in the middle of deflecting real questions with unsubstantiated dog whistles about the trans community and the black community and dropping the mic for applause in the center of who knows how many of his supporters. So, to those of you calling Charlie Kirk's rhetoric just an opinion, you have to be part of the problem. You are likely one of those people who believe that your beliefs will protect you, that if you don't bother with the political stuff, none of it will ever affect you. And that's why I'm going to be on to the next on a not political or other motherfucker on Hinge every time. Really got to get off of Hinge. Hateful opinions like Charlie's lead all the people who feel left out of progress and uplift into this kind of violence and destruction like moss to a flame. They find themselves in crowds like the ones surrounding Charlie to feel like they found their community. Except these spaces aren't about community. They're about control. They are volatile, malevolent, spiraling spaces that capitalize on your familiarity with being excluded by affording you the opportunity to exclude others, all while allowing you to bear the honor or wear the badge of being contrarian. However, those contrarian opinions inform ideologies, which inform politics, and therefore have real-world consequences. Like, I don't know, putting a motherfucker in office that is stripping us of our rights, burning food that could go to homeless people, discarding feminine products that could help women across the globe, sucking the jobs out of this country, making groceries too expensive, and is well on our way to bankrupting this country because enough people agreed with his opinions. And that is the true difference between the left and the right, because we do not believe that our opinions should affect anybody else's quality of life. To those of you calling racism and fascism an opinion, shut up. To all of my political leaders saying violence has no place in this democracy, where you been at? I understand the point of the sentiment, but violence been a part of the fight for real democracy in this country on both sides of the battle since the inception of America. And if you think it shouldn't have a place in the democracy that you're trying to create, then just say that. Semantics absolutely do matter at this point in time. To all the people distraught over this sort of imagery and violence being accessible to us, your apathy for black terror and trauma is showing. We've seen all manner of violence on black bodies for decades. But more than that, your American exceptionalism is showing. Palestinians have had access to this sort of violence in person 365 days straight at this point. They have seen their friends, family members, political figures, journalists obliterated right before their very eyes. The people subject to war and infighting in Sudan have seen one another put down like dogs. The people in the Congo have suffered public executions and amputations ever since King Leopold colonized it for ivory production in 1855 for failure to comply with the demands of their enslavement. And we can't forget the violence that keeps them enslaved to this very day for your iPhone 17s and the mines that collapse and claim more lives every day. Which brings me to the lady screaming, "How dare you," in the video of the first suspect who was brought into custody. How dare you reserve your rage for the biggest mouth and the smallest teeth in history? How dare you reserve your anguish and terror for an agent of hate and chaos? How dare you reserve your heart posture for gun violence against a propagator of gun violence? How dare you reserve your humanity as if human beings have not been suffering atrocities under your vote, your opinion, your ideologies, your religious belief, all of this time. Now, am I celebrating what happened to Charlie Kirk? No, because I know the ripple effect this specific kind of violence can have and how it will ultimately put my community in danger, i.e. the HBCUs getting threats when we didn't have nothing to do with that man doing parkour off the side of that building in Utah. But I am ambivalent about every revolution, B, especially the bad ones. So stop posturing for those who will undoubtedly be seen as villains in the annals of our history. Your feigning righteousness is only prolonging the process. Speaking of righteousness, to all my Christians, the man said he didn't want empathy, so stop giving it to him. You are not being a better Christian than me for giving it to him anyway. He said out of his mouth that the Second Amendment is worth the cost of a few gun deaths per year. So he may have died for a cause, but he did not die on nobody's cross. There was no man of honor. There was no man of God. So stop putting him on that pedestal. Who cares if he had a family? Who cares if they'll one day see the footage? All the vulnerable populations I've referenced today have had families. All the vulnerable populations I've referenced today have had some sort of violence baked into their everyday existence. They're reminded of it every day. They have to come to cope with the trauma of it every single day. George Floyd had a family. His daughter will be able to see that footage anytime for the rest of her life. So should our concern and care not be with the innocents? And what's more, when God said twice, mind you, once in Deuteronomy and once in the book of Romans, vengeance is mine, what do you think he meant by that?
Reporting live from Hyper's Club in Atlanta for Comedy Hype News, I'm John Abba. On Wednesday, September 10th, the nation would end up witnessing the shooting of conservative figure Charlie Kirk as he spoke to a group of college students at Utah Valley University. Now, footage of the shooting would shock many online as they would see the very moment Kirk was shot in the neck by a high-powered gun, causing instant trauma. He would be rushed to a nearby SUV and taken to a hospital about 7 minutes away and would later be pronounced dead. Now, depending on where you are in politics, some saw Charlie as a necessary voice, while others would see him as a controversial figure whose views divided people and attacked marginalized groups. So with that, his death would spark a flood of commentary online, as in recent times he has become a viral political voice, since being featured on several online programs and becoming known for his debate-style content. Now, a part of the conversation taking place, many have raised a question on how should someone who has been accused of hateful views, death, be treated. Several well-known black voices who saw Kirk's views as attacks on them and those who look like them have now spoken out. Dio Hughley would instantly take to his Instagram and his other social media accounts to share his reaction. Now, part of his reaction, Hughley would reshare several clips of Kirk's statements. One of his comments in particular would stand out as it ironically showcases Kirk explaining how he felt gun deaths were necessary.
I think it's worth it. I think it's worth to have a cost of, unfortunately, some gun deaths every single year so that we can have the Second Amendment to protect our other God-given rights.
For his caption of part of the video, Dio would write, in his own words, the power of life and death is in the tongue. Now, as mentioned, many people are asking how should someone like Kirk's passing be seen, given that he has offended so many with his views. Now, Hughley would later release a video of him calling out those who were supporters of Kirk for now wanting others to show empathy, even though it is something that they haven't practiced themselves.
His last words were gang violence. But we know who it was because we know who it wasn't. Three words let you know they weren't black. It was Utah and at large. Now, if Charlie Kirk, we're looking at a situation with Charlie Kirk, would he say he was the victim of crime or white-on-white violence? Because what Charlie Kirk always talked about was how many black people kill black people. But he never talked about how many white people kill white people.
DL would then follow that up with a second video in which he would point out the irony that Kirk was not killed by the black criminals he would always reference during debates. And back on his Instagram, Hughley would also stand against how President Trump is honoring Kirk with half-raised flags. A part of the resharing of the news of Trump honoring Kirk, Hughley would write, but he ordered the flags that were at half-mast for the Pope to be raised. Again, we haven't lowered flags for innocent children who have been unalived. He didn't order the flags lowered for Congresswoman Hortman. It is a tragic event, yes. Does it deserve that ceremony? You know the answer to that. Now, Hughley was not the only notable voice to give their reaction to Kirk's killing. Activist Tariq Nasheed would send out a now-viral message on X just as a potential suspect was arrested by authorities on location. Nasheed would go on to write, Charlie Kirk goes around to campuses talking about how violent black people are. His social media timeline goes on and on about how violent black people are. And in the middle of his speech discussing black gang violence, Charlie gets shot by a white man. As far as the latest around the shooting, the FBI has just confirmed that the shooter, who appears to be of college age, and that a gun that they claim was used in the shooting has been recovered. So let's talk about it more in the comments below. What are your thoughts about this recent shooting?
Go over on the Elon's app. They don't have community guidelines, so you can actually find the videos that are unedited and blurred. Go watch it. It's horrible. It's awful. Watch what one bullet does to a grown man's body in a millisecond. It's horrifying. Go watch it. And watch the unedited version so you can really get an idea of how horrible and violent gun violence is. It's not what we see in movies, right? Go watch it. And then I want you to think about those babies who were praying in church when it was their time. What did the bullets do to their bodies? Maybe it's time we start showing that video. Maybe it's time we start showing those pictures. I mean, maybe the shock value of it will make us realize that we have chosen violence, because all we do in these situations is offer up thoughts and prayers and then make it even easier to access firearms. If we see what those bullets do to babies' bodies, then will you guys stop with this bullshit? And the scary thing is, things are about to get way worse than they already have been. You've got people on the right, like Trump and Fox News, literally calling for violence. I said earlier today that today was one of the biggest FAFO moments ever for this country. And I think for me, it was just that reckoning that we have chosen violence. We have chosen violence. So if we choose violence, we need to see what that violence looks like. We need to be informed. This is what the violence looks like. Here's what happened when those bullets ripped through the bodies of those babies in Uvalde, to the point where some of the parents identified their daughter by her colorful tennis shoes. What about the 20 babies who were slaughtered in Newtown? Kindergartners, first graders, they had special needs. And their teachers who used their bodies to try and shield them. But let's see the pictures, maybe the autopsies. Are there parents out there who will be brave enough to say, this is what it did to my child? Show what happens when bullets go through flesh and bone. Mm. Then, just maybe then, we'll realize thoughts and prayers are never going to be good enough.
That was a woman on TikTok. Welcome back to the hottest show in the galaxy. It's the Karen Hunter Show. Maybe Till Mobley made a decision to open the casket and show her baby and the carnage, and it shook a nation and sparked and gave fuel to a civil rights movement. Maybe that's what it'll take. Drew McCaskill.
Everybody, the whole time she was talking, it made me think about the bravery and the sacrifice of Mamie Till on that. And I think she's right, Karen. I think that we've allowed ourselves to just abdicate our responsibility to actually look at the death, to look at the nation, to look at the fall of democracy. We're just looking away. We're choosing in so many ways. And some of it is to protect our peace and all of the things that we talk about. But honestly, I think that we need to stare the times that we are living in and look at it, stare at it, look at it, sit with it. Because I feel like that's the only way that, unless it happens to us, it's too easy when it's happening to somebody else to just look away, turn the channel, go do something else and say, but if we wait until this death, this end of democracy comes to our front door, we have waited too long. We cannot wait until it's too late to say, I am going to call my congressman. I am going to start an organization. I am going to protest or march or fund an organization or fund the people who are willing to protest and march or figure out something to do, right? Because what she's saying to me is also, I look at these ICE detainees are getting darker and darker by the month. And this is a nation that has essentially required Black people to walk around and show their papers. We do not need to wait until we become a nation where free people, American citizens, have to show their papers to get past checkpoints, right? These ICE detainees are getting darker and darker by the month. And we look at it's all over the news cycle right now of Asian Americans, mobilizing, because now there's so many of them that are being impacted by these ICE strategies and these ICE raids, these sort of Gestapo tactics in all parts of the country. People who have said, oh, I thought we were beyond that. I don't want it to wait until it comes to our doorsteps as Black folks, because it's not far. We've always been on the menu.
Correct.
Right. We might not be the appetizer, but we always been too often in this country. We the main course anyway. They practice on other folks to get to us. And so what that sister is saying is, to me, she's saying, don't look away, because looking away just numbs us until it's on our.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference.